That one. And Mr. Anderson. How do you pronounce that last name?
It's Vivanco, but just Ms. Reynolds is fine.
Ms. Reynolds. That's it. And Mr. Anderson. All right, Ms. Reynolds, you want to, I'm sorry. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine, thank you. You may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Caitlin Reynolds and I represent Travis Stanley this morning. The facts in this case are relatively straightforward. During voir dire, no one asked the jury if anyone knew Marquis Sanders, who was the victim in the alleged offense and the main witness for the Commonwealth in the case. They were not asked by the judge, the Commonwealth, or defense counsel. The jury ultimately was sworn after voir dire was completed, and a recess was called. At that
point, let me have you clarify one point just to be sure. His name was on the witness list that the clerk read to the prospective jurors, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And other questions relating to possible answers regarding bias came up after that, is that right?
Other questions were asked, but no questions were asked specifically about any relationship or prior knowledge of Mr. Sanders.
Just the list.
Yes,
Your Honor. The name on the list.
The name on the list. When the jury was excused for that recess, one of the jurors, Ms. Milner, contacted a bailiff and said, I know him. I know Marquis Sanders. This information was conveyed to the defense counsel, the Commonwealth attorney, as well as the judge. They immediately had a conference in chambers. At that point, defense counsel asked to further question Ms. Milner about her relationship and potential bias. The judge ultimately denied that motion for the reason that the question had never been asked previously, and he did not feel that at this point it should be reopened. He also stated somewhat ambiguously that jeopardy had attached. The Commonwealth attorney did not object to further questioning the juror, but that's how the judge ultimately ruled.
Are you familiar with the case Nelson versus Commonwealth 41 against you?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that is the case involving a foster mother who was a non-witness who previously worked with a juror.
The question there is, it seems to stand for a principle of law that I think is applicable here. If you disagree, of course, I want to hear about that. But to the effect that the trial court should consider the totality of the circumstances and determine, when considering a mid-trial motion to question an impaneled juror, which is what we have here, regarding bias, the trial court should consider the totality of the circumstances and determine whether a party presented credible allegations of bias that undermine the prior determination of impartiality that the court reached. I think that's a principle that can be applied here, is it not? And how would, or maybe you disagree, and if you do, how do you distinguish Nelson?
I would say that in Mr. Stanley's case, there was a greater probability of prejudice simply because it was a juror who came forward in Mr. Stanley's case and said, I know him, the victim. I know him. In contrast, in Nelson, what we have is the foster mother, non-witness, approached the judge and said, I know a juror. They had no evidence in that case that the juror had recognized the foster mother. The foster mother was not a witness. She would never testify in the case. And furthermore, there's no evidence that the juror had even associated the complaining witness, the victim in that case, the foster child, with the foster mother.
Isn't the bottom line, though, in this case, whether knowledge of a victim, knowing the victim, and that's all, is a credible allegation of bias?
I think that it creates the possibility of prejudice because we don't know what that relationship is. They could have been very good friends. It could have been his childhood babysitter. It could have been an aunt. We simply don't know. the juror came forward, notified the court, made a point of telling them that this is the possibility. Defense counsel said, I want to follow that up. I want to ask further about it. I think that the case law sort of sets a ceiling and a floor. The Nelson case may be the floor. We have these speculative links. We have a non-witness potential relationship with the juror. We have not established that the juror has connected the victim to that non-witness. And then we have educational books where we have a juror who says, I am prejudiced against this defendant. I have that prejudice. And there was then some questioning, and the judge said, well, can't you hear the case anyway? And the juror says, well, I suppose I can. And that questioning was deemed to be insufficient.
Aren't we faced with an abuse of discretion standard here, so that the judge says, you had the opportunity to voir dire, and you, for whatever reason, didn't think of asking the question? What's wrong with that?
It is an abuse of discretion standard, but I would argue this is an abuse of discretion. For one reason is that in educational books, the juror says, I am prejudiced. But I think that that is putting a burden on the juror to use these magical words, I am prejudiced, whereas the juror is notifying the court, there is a problem. And it becomes an abuse of discretion when the judge does not look into that potential problem. It is the defendant's burden to show that probability of prejudice. And it's true that it did not come up in voir dire. But ultimately, the judge foreclosed the possibility of defense counsel continuing to pursue that once the issue arose mid-trial. There was a case, I think it's Green versus Commonwealth. Some questions had come up in voir dire, and I believe the court even invited defense counsel to further question a juror about that issue.
I wanted to move back. I'm looking for a case that I thought I had in my notes, but I guess I'll have the Attorney General's office address it if possible. I thought we had at least one case that stands for the proposition that the fact one knows a witness is not sufficient to establish bias. There needs to be something further in the context of maybe further examination. And we are here mid-trial, and no bias. If that case is correctly stated, from my recollection, then that's all you have here. If someone who knew, she didn't say, I know this individual and I don't like him, or maybe not, she was given the opportunity to say, was there anything that would cause you to have an impartial review of the evidence? And if they're all the usual questions about the ability to remain impartial, and at that point she knew a witness. And she didn't answer any of those questions about her ability to serve as an impartial juror in the affirmative. So it would suggest here that at best you have knowledge of a witness, and that's all.
That's what defense counsel was informed of, and that's why I think further questioning was important to establish what that relationship was.
Your argument is that we don't know whether that relationship would cause her to be biased because the court refused the opportunity to make that inquiry.
Yes, Your Honor. There is a case, I'm not sure if this is the case you're thinking of, Brooks versus Commonwealth, I believe was cited by the Commonwealth's brief. And in that instance, the juror had not realized her brother-in-law was the uncle of the two witnesses, but it wasn't clear how well she knew the witnesses. I'm not sure if that's the case you're thinking of.
I'm not sure either, but I want to get back to Judge Petty's question. In this respect, I don't think there is a case that I have found in Virginia law that says you have that the trial court erred in failing to allow a mid-trial inquiry absent some showing of bias. Is there?
I don't believe so.
In the majority, this is the case. You want this to be the case.
Yes, Your Honor. In the majority of the cases, I would note that the juror was ultimately questioned, and the case we were just referring to, with the brother-in-law was the uncle. The
yes.
juror was further questioned. In educational books, the juror was further questioned.
Yes.
In Golombek, the juror was further questioned. There's Green versus Commonwealth. During voir dire, they said, "Have you or an immediate family member been a victim of a violent crime?" Everyone answered no. During deliberations, a note was sent out. Well, some relative was. Well, that was not the question on voir dire.
I think, though, Nelson is the case that tees up the issue. The issue is not, under Nelson, is not whether there is, in fact, bias, but whether there's a credible allegation of bias. And that's what we have to decide, whether the juror saying, "I know the victim," rises to the level of a credible allegation.
Yes, I think that Nelson is the floor as well. That is the other case where there was no further questioning of the juror. The relationship was pretty well fleshed out in the facts of that case. We knew that the juror and the foster mother had worked together previously, about 2 years in the past. The foster mother herself was not to be a witness, and there was much concern there about the speculative links. Did the juror recognize the foster mother? Did she associate the foster mother with the victim? And would it lead to bias? In the case that we have here now, we know that the juror recognized Mr. Sanders. I don't know if it was by his name, perhaps she knew him by a different name, saw him in the courtroom, and at that point realized that she knew him. But
What about the observation in Nelson where we said that if the appellant believed an acquaintance with Lane was an important determinant of possible bias, he had the opportunity to ask that question? I mean, if the appellant, the defendant, thought that a relationship with the victim might establish some type of bias against the defendant, he didn't avail himself of the opportunity to ask the question.
That is true. He did not.
So doesn't that kind of minimize whether the after discovered allegation of bias is in fact credible?
My response to that would be that once the knowledge came forward, once it was disclosed that there was some relationship, some knowledge between them, at that point, everyone is on notice that this relationship of whatever nature it is exists. And at that point, it has to be addressed once it's come forward. Ideally, yes, it should have been brought out in voir dire, and it wasn't. That's simply a fact we have to acknowledge. That's what happened. But I would note that once it comes forward, that's when it has to be dealt with. Things do come up mid-trial in various cases. In one case, a juror congratulated or shook hands with an expert witness and said, "You did a good job," or something of that nature. And that's something that just naturally would come up mid-trial. And it's possible, even had it been asked during voir dire, it's possible that the juror may not have recognized the name, but she recognized the person. Perhaps she knew him by a different name, by a street name. It's not inconceivable that that was the case.
Right. Or you, had heard. You're into your rebuttal, and I just want to alert you to that. You can continue if you wish, or you may reserve.
I'd like to reserve. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. May it please the court, Judge Petty. I have my trusted Casio watch here.
I've heard the story about your watch, Mr. Anderson.
To you for the next 15 minutes. It provides
the same
immaculate,
watch Judge Benton,
immaculate, precise timekeeping. But in the absence of you taking me up on that generous offer, let me just, if I could just sort of rattle off what I think are five circumstances here. There are not really any of them in dispute that I think collectively show that this case should be affirmed. One, there was no false answer here during voir dire. No misleading, incomplete answer. And I think the defense has pretty much conceded that. So therefore, starting point is there's no claim here of jury misconduct. That's the first point. Second, and again, there's no real dispute about this, and I think counsel's pretty much conceded it. The defense could have pursued the matter during voir dire, and for whatever reason did not do so. Absolutely nothing prevented the defense from saying, "Well, you've heard the list of the witnesses in this case. Do you know any of them?" Nothing of the sort happened. Third, the statement that this juror knew, or I would say the governing factor on appeal would be the lesser statement, recognized the person. Either way, there's no indication of facial bias in that answer. It's far different, for example, than the statement of the juror in a murder case during the lunch recess in the Haddad case, where he says, my client, which is a strange reference to the defendant whose case I'm hearing, my client's not going to get off, and how can you defend these guilty people? This, needless to say, this is far less problematical than anything that occurred in
Mr.
that
Anderson,
case.
Is the only information we have as to what the juror actually said the court's comment back in the conference room that one of the jurors mentioned that she knows a witness, and I am told that it is a material witness for the Commonwealth?
That was certainly the initial statement. I will say, and consistent with the principle that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and I think that would be just as true for the appellate court as the trial court, this issue was revisited at sentencing, and the defense, this is, begins at page 255 of the appendix, and the defense attorney says, we'd like a continuance, we'd like to question this juror to see whether in fact there was some bias, need to have the opportunity for an investigator to do that, to see whether the fact she knew the victim didn't bias her decision during the trial. Of course, it could have biased it in favor of the defendant, we'll never know. And the Commonwealth's response at page 256, from what the Commonwealth understands, having spoken with the bailiff that was working the case at the time, is that the juror in question merely recognized one of the witnesses, which I think is, in fact, the more probable, accurate description of what, in fact, was the case, because the judge early on at the voir dire said to the prospective jurors, listen carefully, I'm about to read off the names of the witnesses in this case, one of whom obviously would have been the victim, Mr. Sanders. Nothing transpired after the jurors heard that name during the voir dire to raise any issues.
But the trial judge has some responsibility to see to it that an impartial jury is hearing the case. I understand the jury was impaneled, but no evidence had been heard. Things had not started. What would have been the harm, particularly given that both sides were in agreement? Go ahead and let's do a little extra voir dire.
Well, I think, first of all, I would quibble a little bit about both sides were in agreement. I think the Commonwealth merely said it didn't oppose it, which is not quite the same thing. But nevertheless, the jury had been sworn, had been impaneled, and
well, that would not preclude the judge from seating an additional juror.
No, but still, the fact is that at that point, double jeopardy had attached, so that's at the very outset somewhat of a different, more problematical circumstance.
But my same question, whether jeopardy attached or not is irrelevant. The judge, under the statute, mm-hmm. still can replace a seated juror with an alternative
right.
juror.
Well, the ultimate question here, both on the initial ruling about the failure to conduct additional questioning and then the closely related issue of the denial of the motion for a mistrial, without question, case law establishes on both of those issues it's reviewable as an abuse of discretion, and this court has said any number of times that how we might personally decide a case hardly is proof that an abuse of discretion occurred. What the courts have consistently, both this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia, have pointed to are several things, all of which inure to the Commonwealth's favor in this case. One, is there any indication of juror misconduct? Two, which there's none in here, there's no claim of it. Two, did this occur during the voir dire or at some later point? It's the mid-trial. There's no question that the case law indicates that it's reviewable as an abuse of discretion, and it's comparable to the decision whether to sit a veneer person during voir dire. And we know cases are legion on that is a factual finding of impartiality, and it's due a heavy deference on appeal. Well,
but doesn't it make a difference that the juror took it upon herself to alert the bailiff? It wasn't a case where it was simply discovered after the fact, and it wasn't clear whether the juror even made any, you know, it made any difference one way or another.
Well, I certainly would agree that, for example, in the, I think, the Nelson case, where the foster mother of the victim is the one that brings it to the attention of the authorities, here it's the juror. I don't think that circumstance is in and of itself is nearly enough to conclude that there was an abuse of discretion here. For all we know, the juror is simply trying to be very conscientious. The fact is, there's no indication here to indicate that this juror had any particular close, much less.
But that's the point, and that's the problem we have. We don't know that because the court wouldn't allow the defendant to explore that possibility. It's kind of like, you know, we constantly will affirm cases of an objection on the testimony of a witness where there's no proffer of the witness's testimony. Here, it seems like there's no ability to explore that opportunity, so we just don't know.
If we don't know, in a way, this is a bootstrap argument. If we don't know, it's because the defendant did not do a thing during voir dire to develop or to delve into this issue. If there's uncertainty, it's the defendant's doing. And then later he says, well, we don't really know. Well, we don't know because he didn't do anything during voir dire.
It's not as though this court knew nothing.
Right.
There was a whole series of questions in which the prospective jurors were asked to consider their ability to hear the case without bias, impartial. There are many, many questions that I think go to that. Now,
right.
I didn't specifically say, is it because you know or recognize a witness? So I think to say that there was no opportunity to really know whether bias was prevalent in this particular witness's perceptions, I don't think that's exactly accurate.
No, I don't think it's either fact.
The other thing I want to ask you about is, and maybe I have misread the case. It's Scott versus Commonwealth, Virginia Act. Doesn't that stand for the proposition about when you can't impute bias, which is what you have to do mid-trial, right? Mm-hmm. Given Nelson's ruling, where you don't get to conduct another voir dire mid-trial.
Right.
The only other vehicle for getting to what I think Nelson stands for is to impute bias on the mere fact of recognizing a witness. And I think Scott says you can't do that.
Well, Scott certainly, I think there are two main things. This turned out this was a robbery of a cashier at a U-Crops grocery store. And it turned out during voir dire that one of the veneermen worked at a U-Crops. So on appeal, there are two basic arguments. One, that fact alone required his per se disqualification, which the court rejected. The second one was, if that wasn't true, was the fact that he worked at the U-Crops sufficient to warrant his removal for cause? Now, it turned out, as this court pointed out in its opinion, which, by the way, the Supreme Court of Virginia in the second-tier appeal upheld for the very same reasons, the court pointed out that there were, after he said, I'm employed at U-Crops, there was additional voir dire in which the defense asked about, well, do you shop at U-Crops? Could this somehow have an impact? But there was nothing further. Well, you work at the U-Crops. Where did you work? Did you know any of these people? Would your connection to U-Crops predispose you against the defendant? Nothing of the sort happened. So then on appeal, for the first time, they say, well, the fact he worked at U-Crops meant he shouldn't have served. And this court said, first of all, point out the trial court had invited the attorneys to, quote unquote, question the jurors. And then the court said, quote, although Scott's trial counsel asked whether the fact that Veneermen shopped at U-Crops would affect their judgment, he did not pursue Henderson's employment relationship. The record does not disclose whether, in fact, Henderson was employed at the store where the robbery occurred, whether he had acquired information about the crime through his employment, or whether he was acquainted with the U-Crops clerk who was robbed. We can only speculate as to whether this line of inquiry would have disclosed any bias or prejudice on Henderson's part. I submit that reasoning closely applies
to
here.
I wanted to mention the Barrett case as well. I think the posture of this case is a little different than the cases we're citing, and it is that if all you have is a juror that says I recognize a witness,
right,
and if Nelson is to stand for the proposition that we began with, which is you have to show some credible allegation of bias to allow mid-trial questioning, the only way you can get there is in a case such as this is to impute bias by virtue of that relationship. I recognize the witness. In Barrett, there was a past acquaintance with a witness. between the juror and the witness. And all those cases say there is no per se attribution of bias. So if you can't get there through a per se analysis, which would trigger the right to question, I'm not sure how you... how one would proceed.
Well, I would put it in slightly different terms, but I think it's another way of basically saying the same thing. If the matter that's at issue on appeal is something that the defense plainly had the right to delve into during voir dire, and thereby, among other things, removing any factual uncertainty, such as here, and you've just heard the names of the witnesses, including the victim, Mr. Saunders. Do any of you know him? If you do, how long have you known him? What kind of, are you friendly with him, unfriendly? You get all sorts of questions that could plainly have been done on voir dire, were not. So that's the first point. The second point is the answer, and I submit that for purposes of deciding this case, that the court should factually assume that she merely recognized him. But even if it's somehow she knew him, which I don't think is appreciably more or better for the defendant, it's not on its face indicative of any bias. She might have hated him. Might have said, you know, if she heard he was the one that got beat up, said, good riddance. Yeah, we'll never know. So if there's any uncertainty here, it is entirely driven by the defendant's failure to conduct voir dire on something he plainly could have pursued. He didn't do it. And as I say, it's basically a bootstrap argument. Well, I didn't do this, and therefore, based on my failure to do this, I now rely on the uncertainty. Whatever it is, it's not an abuse of discretion under these cases, such as in particular Nelson, Green, Scott. The courts have consistently hammered the point that the defense could have pursued a question on voir dire, and it didn't.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, if you check with your incredibly accurate Casio see if it agrees my incredibly accurate iPad, I think
your
Honor, is fired.
At this late point in my career, I have learned the Casio watch is not instinctively and invariably correct versus the immaculate timekeeping of my panels.
Thank you very much.
I would
much.
Ask the court to affirm.
Mr. Reynolds, let me ask you, as you approached, to respond to a question that I kind of posed to Mr. Anderson. When we deal with cases involving a court's reluctance or unwillingness to allow testimony of a witness, we require the party to proffer that evidence so that on review we could determine whether or not it was either admissible or perhaps harmless not to admit it. I noticed that this case was tried on January 24th and sentencing occurred on March 21st, both of 2013, but the record is devoid of any attempt on the part of the defendant to explore any possible bias on the part of the witness so that you could establish or proffer at a later date this credible allegation of bias. Can you go into that? I mean, why shouldn't that perhaps resolve this issue?
I think on the day of trial, there was simply no time to speak with the juror.
Well, I understand that, but there's 2 months between the verdict and the sentencing, or I should say on the verdict and the motion to set aside, that you could have explored that and proffered it to the court.
Defense counsel who handled the trial ultimately didn't pursue that. When it came time for the motion that you're talking about, I believe he did ask for a continuance and ask at that point.
But why wasn't it explored when there was an opportunity to explore it? And shouldn't we require in a case like this at least a proffer that would elevate the mere suspicion of bias to that credible allegation of bias level?
It would be helpful to have that information, certainly, because then we would know. We would know what is the relationship. But I think that's fundamentally what this case is about. Should the court have allowed that further voir dire so that we, in fact, can know, so that the judge could have known? An impartial jury is certainly a fundamental aspect of a fair trial, and that is the question here. Did we have an impartial jury, and should the judge have allowed defense counsel to further voir dire once it came up? I would note that in educational books, there were these sort of routine questions, can you be unbiased? Can you hear this case? To which all of the jurors answered yes. After answering yes repeatedly, one juror said, oh, wait, I've now realized, in fact, I do have prejudice. It was disclosed later, much as in this case. And I would argue that those are the facts that this case tracks. The juror answered those somewhat more routine and formulaic questions, yes, I can be unbiased. Oh, wait, I have this knowledge.
Your position is the mere fact of knowing a witness or recognizing a witness is indicative of bias.
I think it's indicative of a possibility of bias.
Well, anything, I suppose you could say, fits under that rubric.
But enough of a probability of bias that the court should have allowed this further questioning.
Isn't that a completely neutral fact?
I think it's not necessarily neutral. It could be neutral, but it could be decidedly unneutral, and we simply don't know. I would note in the Scott case, where we're talking about simple knowledge or association, where we have the employee, that did come out in voir dire, and I believe that the judge questioned the juror twice, both about his employment relationship and about a previous crime that he was a part of, and he answered affirmatively on the record, I can be objective, I can do this. So we have that answer in Scott, and I think that entirely distinguishes it from this case, in which we don't have any answer to that effect once the juror has disclosed this knowledge. Well, can you then therefore go forward and be unbiased? We do not have that answer, and that is what creates this possibility of the probability of prejudice here in this case, and that's why I'm asking the court to reverse.
Thank you very much. So we will greet counsel, and then we're going to take a very brief recess.